Today on Wings, a theologian looks at Catholic Church conflicts about women and about the poor.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In August 2022, Pope Francis changed the status of Opus Dei, an organization that has been associated with reactionary ideology and the rollback of the 1960s reforms known as Vatican II. From the Wings archives, here's some history of church struggles over the hot-button issues of women and the poor.
This is Mary O'Grady. Joanna Manning is the author of Is the Pope Catholic? A Woman Confronts Her Church. I asked Joanna Manning what it was like to study theology as a Roman Catholic woman during the Second Vatican Council.
Actually, I was a nun in England. That's where I was born and grew up and was educated by nuns. And I studied theology as a nun in the 60s at the time of the Vatican Council. And it was a tremendously exciting and innovative period in the history of the church. It was kind of like a flowering of the Catholic Church, which unfortunately has ceased to bloom in the present time, but it was a great time to be studying theology.
Well, what exactly was the Second Vatican Council, or Vatican II as it's known?
It was a universal council of the church, which meant that at that time the way people thought was that the bishops represented the whole of the church, and so all the bishops of the world were called to Rome to discuss what the Pope, who called the Vatican Council, it was John the 23rd, in an Italian phrase, he said the church needs aggiornamento, which means bringing up to date, and the church needed to discuss the issues that confronted the modern world and to bring itself in line with the trends in philosophy and social thinking going on in the modern world. And so he called this council, and it proved to be quite revolutionary. Initially, the Vatican officials, the bureaucrats at the Vatican, tried to stifle a lot of the freedom of thought and discussion that was going on at the Vatican Council, but they were actually outmaneuvered by some of the bishops from the States and from Europe and from other parts of the world who were much more in touch with the people and much more aware of how the world was changing and knew that in order to survive, the Catholic Church had to bring itself up to date. So it was a relatively short period, and certainly in terms of the Catholic Church history, it only lasted for 3 years. But in that 3 years, there was an incredible motion of change that was set in movement in the church.
What were a few of the specific changes that resulted from Vatican II?
One of the most significant was the redefinition of the church. The redefinition of the church came away from the very rigid idea that people had of the church being a very male-dominated and hierarchical institution, which was patterned after the Roman Empire and which really hadn't changed its governing structures ever since the time of the Roman Empire. So the church in the old idea consisted of the Pope, the bishops, and priests. And then, you know, there was sort of the rest of us who, in the old phrase, paid, prayed, and obeyed. But we weren't as full members of the church in this way of thinking as were the bishops and the priests. And the Vatican Council did a very significant move, and it went back to, it looked to the early days of the church when Jesus was around and also immediately after Jesus had died. And it came up with a new but a very old definition of the church, which said the church is fundamentally the people of God. And all the baptized, in other words, the laity and men and women and everybody else, are fundamentally equal in the church. And that the gifts of the Spirit, like the Catholics believe that the Holy Spirit works in each person and endows them with gifts that they can use for the transforming of the world, that these gifts are present in every single person. And every single person is called to be holy. That was another whole concept. And that was part of the reason why I left the convent during this time, was that I had been brought up thinking that in order to really please God and to serve God, you had to be a nun or a priest. And so I had gone into the convent because I wanted to dedicate my life to God. And the Vatican Council really blew the walls from out of that way of thinking and said, you don't have to leave the world in order to dedicate your life to God. In fact, the church should be right inside the world and in contemporary society. And that's where God is at work, and that's where the Spirit is at work. It was a very, very big shift in thinking.
What happened to this kind of democratization?
Well, I think that the people in Rome got scared. They realized that if the structure changed so radically, they would lose their power. And unfortunately, at the top echelons of the church, there are people who are very ambitious and whose sole desire is to keep people under control. Power is tremendously captivating. And somebody once said to me that power is the aphrodisiac of the celibate. And I think that they realized that the power of the church, the Roman church, would cease to exist in its present form were the reforms of the Vatican Council put into motion. And with the election of John Paul II, who actually had not experienced a great deal of the Vatican Council, he saw that this was a very dangerous move, and he tried to retrench control once more into centralized control, because one of the things that the Vatican Council started was meetings of the Pope with bishops, and the bishops were to advise the Pope and to come up with policies that were made in a... Now, this isn't democracy, because it's still just the top people in the hierarchy, but still it was an improvement on the Pope as the sole arbiter of everything that went on in the church. This started in the 70s, but then with the election of John Paul II, he grabbed back the centralization of control in Rome. The other thing that was also happening was, although the Vatican Council didn't really develop the idea of the equality of women, the fact that it has said that all people in the church, women and men equally, who are baptized, have a basic equality, from that base, a number of people were saying, if women truly are equal to men in the church as well as outside, then we should start looking at the possibility of ordaining women and having women in power in the church. And this was one of the other things that was tremendously threatening to the male celibate hierarchy in the church.
Can you talk a little bit about the traditional Roman Catholic theologians like Thomas Aquinas? How did they look at women?
Oh, women were the temptations of the devil. I mean, women embodied in the flesh all that would lead men from the path of holiness. I mean, St. Augustine, for example, who was before Thomas Aquinas, who had a tremendous influence on Aquinas and on the church in the West, said that the reason why you can't allow women on the altar is because they cause holy men, i.e. priests, to have erections.
Oh.
So women were regarded, women's bodies were regarded as dangerous, and women's wiles were regarded as the supreme temptation of the flesh. And so in order to focus on what was holy, a priest must not have any commerce with women, or a priest must be celibate. Now, this had not been at all the ideal of Jesus, and it was certainly not practiced in the New Testament times. None of the apostles, except possibly one, John, was a celibate. The church got captured by ideas that were prevalent in Greco-Roman society about the inequality of women. It wasn't until after 1,000 years of the church's foundation that celibacy was actually enforced. But it's very interesting, and I examine this in my book about how Aquinas argues against the ordination of women. Because Aquinas says that in the regular everyday life, women and men are not equal because women are simply not capable of performing the tasks of men. He calls women defective males. However, Aquinas said, when women are baptized as Christians, they become equal with men because, and this has always been the teaching of the church ever since the beginning, baptism confers a likeness to Jesus Christ equally on women as well as on men. So Aquinas says, okay, women can never be equal in the political or ordinary sphere, but they are equal in baptism. But, he said, it would give scandal to have women in positions of authority in the church over men. And so in order to realize this equality between women and men that is given by the sacrament of baptism, women will just have to wait till heaven. And in heaven, everybody will be equal, and it'll all be fine and rosy. But here on earth, in order for the church not to give scandal, we have to keep to the secular norm and keep women in their place. So they can't possibly be ordained as priests.
Now, is this kind of notion still in favor with the church?
Oh, yes. But they know that they can't use those arguments anymore. It's very interesting. They've twisted, and I think in a very serious way, they have undermined the traditions of the Catholic Church now in order to keep women out of the priesthood. John Paul II cannot argue anymore that women will give scandal if they are seen to be equal with men. In regular secular society, pretty well every position is open to women. So you can no longer argue that it would give scandal for women to be seen as equal in authority to men. So he said there is a fundamental anthropological difference between women and men, that there are two different kinds of human nature. There's a male human nature and a female human nature. And God has set up female human nature primarily for one purpose only, and that is for motherhood and to bear children. So women's exalted role, now it's very interesting because he couches this in very exalted language. Women's very exalted role of motherhood means that their primary duty is within the home and within the hearth. And other things that come, I mean, okay, some women have to work, true, to earn a living. And yes, women can do things outside the home and they can be prime ministers and everything else. But all of this is a sideline in their true vocation, their true destiny in the world, which is to be the mothers of society. And the male person more or less does everything else. And because Jesus Christ was male and took a male human nature, and this is where the very, I've called it heretical, which means it undermines fundamentally a teaching of the church. It's a very different teaching than Aquinas said. The Pope says, because Jesus Christ was a male, therefore only somebody who has a male human nature can fully resemble Jesus as a priest and become a priest. And when it boils down to it, all his arguments about what constitutes a male human nature boil down to the fact that biologically men are different from women. And men have a penis and women don't. And so the only difference is the physical difference between men and women. He goes at great lengths to put these arguments in very exalted philosophical and theological language. And all his writings about women are, on the superficial level, very wonderful. He seems to respect women. He reveres the Virgin Mary. But when you unravel his arguments, they're absolute nonsense. He's putting women on a pedestal, but from that pedestal, they can no longer threaten men. So he's sort of putting women out of touch with everyday society. They're just a different kind of human nature. But on the other hand, if women don't conform to this image of the mother, the Virgin Mary, this glowing human being who is supposed to nurture and protect the world, somehow if they fail in that nature, then they are responsible for all the bad things that happen in the world. He actually said to Nafis Sadiq, when he was talking to her about the Cairo conference, something to the effect that, do you not think that women are responsible for all the failures of men? This is a horrendous, horrendous kind of way of thinking, because that leads down the spiral. If you think that if a woman fails in her duty to mother men and society into their true nature, if you go down that spiral, then you say, if my woman has failed me, and if she's not perfect, then I can do what I, you know, she deserves to be punished. She deserves to be beaten. She deserves whatever is coming to her because she failed in her fundamental duty as a woman. It's a very convoluted way of thinking, but it's a very, very, very dangerous way of thinking. And that's why it has to be exposed for what it is.
Does the Roman Catholic Church currently hold that God is male?
That's a tough question to answer. They do, because in all the documents of the Church, God is referred to as Father. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Scholarship in the Roman Catholic Church does not hold that God is male. But, for example, the Church came out with this document that supposedly the summary of all the teachings of the Catholic Church, and it's called the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And it was originally written in Latin. It was put together in Latin, and then it was put out to be translated in different countries. The first U.S. translation that was produced went to great lengths to try and use inclusive language wherever possible, certainly for human beings, and also for God. Rather than saying all the time, God is Father, etc., they had used terms like Creator, or they had simply not used terms for God. They had just said God. And for men and women, they had used humanity rather than the generic man. Well, after very lengthy negotiations, a span of about 4 or 5 years, the Vatican forced the American bishops to revert to non-inclusive language for God and non-inclusive language for humanity. So God is everywhere and at all times to be referred to as Father, and humanity is everywhere and at all times to be referred to as man. So I think that they really do believe, and I believe, again, this is an heretical doctrine, because God is certainly not male, if God is God, but they do believe that God seems to be only revealed as Father, as a male.
But is it not true that the Pope will no longer permit even discussion of the priestly ordination of women?
Well, he's tried to stop it, and he's threatened people with excommunication if they continue to discuss it. And in fact, there have been some women in universities, Barbara Freund is one, for example, in the States, and Ivone Gabara, who's a Brazilian theologian, who've been removed from their positions because they continue to discuss the equality of women.
And what is Opus Dei?
Opus Dei is a movement within the Church that was started in fascist Spain, founded by a priest called Jose Maria Escriva, who was a follower of Franco and whose members fought on the fascist side in the Spanish Civil War. It's a highly conservative, highly male-oriented, rigidly doctrinaire movement that seeks to influence the upper classes into a very authoritarian and traditional form of Catholicism. It operates in the fashion of a semi-cult. It was powerful in Spain, and it was powerful in some other countries in Latin America, which had a Spanish influence. But it was never powerful in the Church as a whole until the time of John Paul II, because he has given Opus Dei more or less free rein in the Vatican. In fact, his press spokesperson, Joaquin Navarro-Valls, is an Opus Dei man. And also, he has given Opus Dei the right within the Church to act without having to be under the authority of local bishops. So, for example, Opus Dei in Washington or New York or wherever reports directly to Rome. They can do what they like within a diocese without having the bishop of the local diocese interfere or be in authority over them. So they operate their own houses. They often try to get access into universities because they see the elite classes as being the ones that they want to control. They're very wealthy. They're funded by some large corporations, but they're also very secretive in what they do. So they sort of act as the Pope's eyes and ears in the local diocese, and they're quite powerful in the Vatican, and they favor a very rigid and old-fashioned form of Catholicism where, for example, the inequality of women is absolutely not considered at all. In fact, women have a subordinate role within Opus Dei. The fact that this movement has become so powerful in the church is kind of a sign of the times in terms of what John Paul II has stood for.
Could you talk a little bit about the preferential option for the poor and whatever happened to that?
Yes, the preferential option for the poor was a movement that came out of Latin America. Shortly after the Second Vatican Council, the bishops and the theologians of Latin America met to see how they could implement the vision of the Vatican Council that the church was the people of God and that the Holy Spirit was animating the church from below, so to speak, through the laity and also through movements in the world. And they began to see that one of the movements that was really calling the church for conversion in Latin America was the growing consciousness that the gap between rich and poor was something sinful, in a sense. Traditional theology has always taught that if you were poor, you would be redeemed and you would be holy in heaven. But here on earth, the more that you suffered, the holier that you would be, because poverty made you suffer. And suffering makes you like the crucified Christ, and so therefore you are closer to Christ if you're poor, and your reward will be greater in heaven. But shortly after the Vatican Council, people began to realize that this is a travesty of theology, and that in fact, poor people are not destined by God to be poor. The fact that Christ became poor was a choice that God made to work amongst the poor, because the poor were the ones who could hear the good news of the gospel, because they were less corrupted by riches, but that their poverty in and of itself did not necessarily make them holy. And they began to say that the traditional theology has been used by the rich in Latin America to keep the poor down. A number of leaders arose in Latin America. For example, one of them was Archbishop Romero, who said that the poor deserve to be liberated and that the rich must share, and that in fact the church must be a sign to the rich that in order to follow Christ, one must in fact choose the preferential option for the poor. So in order to be most like Jesus Christ, the church and all members of the church should voluntarily choose poverty. So Romero began a process that the rich found very threatening. He began to move out of his dwelling as an archbishop, because a bishop in Latin America or anywhere really has the status of an upper-class rich person, traditionally. And Romero said that he had to show a lead and to renounce this. So he moved out of the archbishop's dwelling. He did not choose, for example, to spend money repairing churches. He put money into schools and into nutrition programs and so on for the poor. But above all, he began to say that the church had a duty to support the cry of justice for the poor, which meant that the land had to be redistributed and wealth had to be redistributed. And for calling for this kind of preferential option for the poor, he got labeled as a Marxist. It was a very easy label. And of course, with John Paul II coming as he did from the background in Poland of fighting against communism and Marxism, he viewed Latin America through the eyes of Eastern Europe and said that anything that smacked of Marxism was evil and therefore to be resisted. Also, politically, John Paul II had made an alliance with Reagan when Poland was in upheaval in the 80s. And the church and Reagan worked very closely together in terms of the fall of communism in Poland. And as a result, in return for this, Reagan and John Paul II made an agreement where the church said that it would back off in terms of the struggle for liberation in Latin America in order not to threaten the hemispheric interests of the United States in that region. So Romero, in a sense, was sacrificed, because Romero got very little support in Rome for his views, and when he was assassinated, not a single bishop came to his funeral. The same thing has happened more recently in Guatemala with Girardi, who was assassinated, who was trying to do much the same thing as Romero. Something similar happened to Bishop Helder Camara in São Paulo, Brazil, whose diocese was redivided and subdivided by Rome because he had become too much of a champion of the poor.
Why do you stay in the church?
For two reasons, really, Mary. I stay in the church because it's in my bones and I love it. I've been a cradle Catholic, nurtured by the Catholic saints, by Catholic practices, by the sacraments, and by the mysticism of the church, and I still draw on that. So in my deepest soul, I consider myself Catholic, though not in an exclusive sense. The other reason is because I believe as a woman and as a theologically educated woman that I have a duty to speak out on behalf of women at this juncture of history. Because what Pope John Paul II is preaching about women is not only wrong, it's dangerous and it's heretical. He has to be called on women because the policies of the Catholic Church on women are providing theological framework for attitudes amongst men that foster violence against women and discrimination against women. So I stay within the Catholic Church in order to fight for women. Because if I were to leave, I would simply be dismissed. Oh yeah, you know, there she goes, another fallen away Catholic, one of those feminists who, you know, has been captured by the evil spirit of feminism and so on and so forth. I would be dismissed. So it's a very lonely struggle at times to stay within the church, but I believe that at this juncture of history, that's where God is calling me to be, and that's where I'll stay.
Joanna Manning, her book, Is the Pope Catholic? A Woman Confronts Her Church, was published in Canada by Malcolm Lester Books of Toronto. I'm Mary O'Grady for Wings.
This program was first recorded in 1999. After the election of Pope Benedict XVI, Manning did abandon Catholicism. She became a priest in the Anglican Church of Canada and has published two more books, Take Back the Truth, Confronting Papal Power and the Religious Right, and The Magdalene Moment, Vision for a New Christianity. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.